From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, Brigham Young University President Kevin Worthen announced the school would consider making changes to its honor code policy related to sexual assault. The president was responding to stories by BYU students who said when they reported being sexually assaulted, that information was passed along to the honor code office, and some say they were punished as a result. One group of women confronted BYU's Title IX coordinator, who reportedly told them the school would not apologize for referring abuse victims for discipline. As one victim's advocate put it, BYU is really just reflecting the same attitude you get from the broader American culture and justice system, where women feel shamed or blamed when they're assaulted. Still, it's a legitimate question to ask how the story is playing out in Utah, in Mormon culture, and that's what we'll do after the news. This week on Video West, go see filmmaker Nate Gunn's piece on Ogden photographer and mountaineer Andy Earle. Tragedy can change things, make you want to back off, stay home. But Andy had to fill his heart with something, and he found it in the Utah mountains. Go to videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, you've heard the story of BYU's honor code policy and sexual assault victims. The Salt Lake Tribune is one of the first news organizations to report the stories of BYU co-eds who had reported being sexually assaulted and then referred to the school's honor code office. And in some cases, they were punished for violating that code. Now, it's important to say they weren't punished for being raped or being attacked. They were punished, or anyway evaluated, for the circumstances surrounding the attack, like if they were at a party and people had been drinking or using drugs, or if there had been consensual sex at some point. Those parts are obviously against BYU's rules, and the school seemed to believe, and may still believe, you can separate one from the other. It's hard to make sense of it all, and what seems to be clear is that in some ways this story is not, in fact, unique at all to Provo. Victims' advocates all over the country say that you can find this kind of thinking where people who are abused and then questioned about what they were wearing or what they'd been drinking or whether they had used bad judgment in some way and that that had contributed to the attack. So to stay in the program, we're talking about how this story is typical, but also how it may be unique. How does the Mormon view of chastity and virtue complicate things? Joining us first on the program is Erin Alberty, justice and safety reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She's been covering this story for the paper, and thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you.
So when did you first hear about these stories that were coming?
Well, I'd heard some discussion about this for a while now, but it was a little difficult to find sources who had experienced sexual assault while students at BYU and who would talk about it. However, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a rape awareness event on campus that several students had gone to, and there had been other rape awareness events earlier in the week that I'm hearing that some other students who had experienced sexual assault at BYU had kind of met each other at. And one of the students at that rape awareness event, her name is Maddie Barney, she raised this issue of if you report a sexual assault, you might be investigated for honor code violations. Mm-hmm. She raised it with a representative of the BYU Police Department who was there and with the Title IX coordinator who was sitting in the audience. And so she brought this up, and then from there the issue kind of picked up steam on social media, and we were able to find a number of people who said this had been something they'd had experience with.
Yeah. The Tribune's policy is not to publish the names of assault victims unless they consent.
Right, so, and Maddie has consented.
She had, and then there were a few others, and some who didn't. So Maddie's case, this was interesting. Her future enrollment at BYU, at least you had reported, was on hold pending this honor code investigation. Is that still the case?
Yeah. Yeah, that is. She had not participated in an honor code investigation that began after a deputy from the Utah County Sheriff's Department had taken her police file to the school.
That is outrageous.
That's an interesting twist of the story.
Yep. That's a more tempered way of putting it. But yeah, so he takes this report and says, now, Isn't it also true that this police officer had some sort of relationship with the rapist
or the alleged suspect?
With the suspect.
Yeah. So the defendant and this sheriff's deputy knew each other, and this is how prosecutors allege that he got a hold of this investigative report. Because this isn't just like an initial contact report with a paragraph of information; it was more than 20 pages of detailed victim statements. The medical reports from her CODAR exam, which they do after somebody's sexually assaulted. The sheriff's department, which did not investigate Maddie's rape case, that was Provo Police. The sheriff's department said that this deputy got a hold of this not as a result of being a law enforcement officer, but he is a law enforcement officer. Both he and the suspect were charged by prosecutors in Utah County with witness retaliation, because when they took it to the school, the honor code then opened an investigation into Maddie and put her registration on hold.
And that's still pending.
Yeah, that's still pending. So prosecutors have told Maddie, she says prosecutors have told her, and prosecutors have told us they told her, not to participate in the honor code investigation until the trial is over.
Yeah.
They wanted to, you know, preserve the integrity of their case.
Do we know what the school is in effect, or at least the honor code office is saying to her? Are they saying, look, we're not punishing you, and you won't be punished for being raped. That would be crazy, but maybe you were drinking, Maddie, maybe there was drugs. Maybe there had been at some point in this process consensual sex. I mean, what would be the point for them investigating there in the first place?
Well, I don't know what honor code violation they believe that she committed. They haven't spoken specifically about her case. I do want to point out that the charges against the deputy and the suspect, the witness retaliation charges, were dropped.
Okay. And we should also say that the sheriff's department has said he was just acting in the interests of trying to protect victims. That was the...
Yeah, he said he was... Well, according to the sheriff's department, he said he was trying to protect female athletes from potential sexual assault. His attorney said that he was trying to implicate male athletes. It's not exactly clear how that figures in, because there aren't... Neither Maddie nor the suspect in the rape case are athletes at BYU.
So... this is a policy of Brigham Young University, because that's the question. Is this a policy that anytime you are investigated, anytime you report a sexual assault, that just is a matter of course, it goes over to the honor code office, or is this just some dumb, clumsy response?
According to students that we've talked to, two of whom were found one of whom was conclusively found by the honor code to have broken no school rules. The other, of whom her case is on hold because they can't get other witnesses to cooperate because there's a pending criminal case in that situation also, which is separate from Maddie Barney's situation. Both of them say they didn't commit any honor code violations. There wasn't any allegation or evidence of any honor code violations. The only reason that they were held in suspicion by the honor code office was the fact that they'd reported a rape. That's what those two women at BYU have said. And they also have said that people at the Title IX office, which investigates sexual assault allegations for the school, that staff there told them that this was a policy, that my hands are tied by the policy. This is what we do. The school hasn't spoken specifically to that in their responses.
Yeah. Do you have any indication how many times something like this has happened over the years? Are you just starting to dig in?
No. I mean, we started with 4 accounts in our first story. However, at that time, I had spoken with 6 students who said they'd been investigated in connection to sexual assaults where they reported being the victim. We've heard from several more, but obviously our contacts do not represent the entire universe of people who have experienced sex crime while at BYU.
Yeah, of course. So give me a sense of how the school is reacting to your inquiries into the case generally. I know we should mention that President Kevin Worthen has made a video statement. We can put a link to it, in fact, on our website, and suggested that the honor code, as he says in that statement, is supposed to protect people, make them feel safe. But he did seem to suggest that there's this study now that they're engaging in, and that there could be some changes, that maybe this isn't an ideal policy. Is that the sense you're getting from them?
Well, I mean, the statements on the quality of the policy have been quite brief, so it's hard to get a read on what they think or what their reaction is immediately. They did say they were studying that, and they didn't say specifically what. They were looking at structural changes, and I can say that we spoke to one student. Her name is Madeline. This isn't Maddie. This is a different student, Madeline McDonald, who also has agreed to be identified by name, who said that she was one of them that they didn't find any violations of. But she made a request under the federal laws that regulate education records. And she said she got a hold of her file from the Honor Code office, which was 87 pages long. Wow. She said it included a lot of detail about stuff that she didn't think had to do with whether she had been sexually assaulted.
Like what? Can you say?
Well, for example, text messages from a representative of student government that she'd gone to see about changing the practice of investigating victims in sex crimes for Honor Code violations. To somebody else, she doesn't know who, but it wasn't to her, and it was about her complaining about this practice, not particularly about the sexual assault that she had reported.
That's weird.
Well, that's she said that. Yeah, she said that was weird.
Yeah.
Now, she also found when she opened that case that the Honor Code file had been opened the same day she'd made the report to Title IX, which she had been directed to by the Women's Resource Center. Yeah. The school said that they use the same tracking system for Title IX as they did for the Honor Code. That's the system they had in place for the Honor Code. And then when Title IX began to require more detailed tracking of these sexual assault investigations, they just used that system. Hmm. So just because it was said it was open that day doesn't mean that the Honor Code office began investigating that day. That's what the school says.
Right.
But they said that overlap of software, that overlap of tracking systems is one of the structural changes that they're considering changing. I don't really know what else.
Yeah. I wonder, it seems like what BYU, the way they're seeing all of this is that it's possible to separate one from the other.
They've consistently used this language that the Title IX investigations and Honor Code investigations are separate. Yes.
But I guess, and this is part of what you're looking at and reporting on, how can that be separate? How can you tease out the circumstances of an attack from the attack? I mean, BYU seems to be suggesting that they're not of a context, that they can be teased out and one can be punished and one can not be, I guess. Yeah?
Well, the students we've talked to said that that's just kind of a paperwork fiction, that it's not – they're not separate. It doesn't change the fact that for a victim in a sexual assault, they're going to get in trouble still as a result of making the report. Violations that never would have come to light without them making a report are going to come to light, and they're going to be punished for that. And not just the students that we've talked to who said that they were sexually assaulted, but also police are complaining that this is creating a serious chilling effect on victims, that it's making it, when they're already vulnerable, very difficult to make a report when their education maybe on the line. And it has been. We've talked to at least two students who have been suspended or expelled outright in connection to making reports of sexual assault.
Is the LDS Church, as far as you can tell, nervous about complying entirely with Title IX because there might be a religious liberty issue at stake? They're a private institution. They don't want to be necessarily beholden to all these federal regulations because they want to make a distinction between private and public.
I haven't had any contact with the church on this, and I'm not sure what the church's reaction is to. Obviously, they own BYU.
Yeah.
We did speak with some Title IX experts, including a person who helped write some of the laws around Title IX, and he said that there is a lot of flexibility in Title IX, and BYU is not the only school in America to have an honor code that's more restrictive than criminal law. So what that person said was, okay, they didn't think that BYU's practices were within the spirit of Title IX, which they hoped would protect victims. However, they said within the letter of the law, you know, they make room for a lot of different approaches, and different schools can choose to do different things with that.
Maddie Barney had proposed some kind of immunity clause for the Honor Code. The idea being that if you know some of the circumstances of your that, you know, if you know some of these circumstances of your abuse could get you in trouble in the honor code, you're just going to keep that to yourself because you don't want to get in trouble. So if there was an immunity clause, then it would make more people perhaps come, you know, come out and talk. Is the school even thinking about this at this point, or what do you know about that?
Well, I mean, as you said, this is a private institution, yep. So that they don't make all of their affairs known to the world. But we just don't know. That has been the main request that most people who are reacting to these revelations have been making.
Erin Alberti, she is justice and safety reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a story about BYU co-eds who had reported sexual assaults and then had been reported to and in some cases punished by the school for violating their honor code. Now, in some ways, this is not unlike the reaction for women all over the country, not just women, other people who are sexually abused too as well. And these people wonder sometimes if they'll be believed or if they'll be shamed or if they'll be blamed for being a victim. But the LDS culture and theology about sexual virtue and chastity may complicate things, so we're talking about that element as well today. Joining us on the program is Andrea Radke Moss, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho. She writes about Mormon women's history and contributes to the Mormon history blog Juvenile Instructor. She's joining us from her office in Rexburg, Idaho, and we should point out that Professor Radke Moss is not speaking on behalf of BYU Idaho or, of course, the LDS Church. And Professor Radke Moss, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also today, Cynthia Bailey Lee is joining us. She blogs about feminist issues on the Mormon blog By Common Consent. She's a lecturer at Stanford University, joining us from a studio there. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be on. Thanks.
Well, let's begin with, and maybe I'll direct this to Cynthia Bailey Lee first. Before we dig into the particulars of the LDS part of the story, I suppose we should talk about and acknowledge, as this is something you've written about, the idea that we don't really seem to have a good grip on, in some ways, what sexual assault really looks like, as you've put it. Because you say there's this kind of pervasive belief that partying and alcohol or drugs are part of making this happen, and that's just not how it works. Would you talk about that part of the story first?
Sure. So I think there isn't what I see of the conversation around this news about BYU, a lot of reflection of the same misconceptions about sexual assault that we see in the national conversation that's been, you know, at the fore for the last few years. And it tends to be that we think sexual assault falls into one of two categories, that it is this stranger danger model, you know, the man in the trench coat pops out from behind a bush as you're jogging around campus in the evening, yeah. Or the bad sex model, that two people are drinking and something sort of clumsily happens, and then the next day there are regrets and recriminations. And neither of those is very accurate for what is predominantly happening with campus sexual assault, where very often alcohol or other substance abuse is involved, but not in the that kind of bad sex model. What we see is that rape is committed by a rapist, which it's unfortunate that needs saying, but the role that alcohol often plays is as a tool. That is, someone decides to rape, and the alcohol is facilitating that by lowering the capacity of the victim and also inhibiting the credibility of that victim should they later choose to report. So it is the case that alcohol is involved in many campus sexual assaults nationally, but I think the role that it plays or the causality is often misunderstood by people.
Yeah, because in the context of BYU, let's say, where there's not a lot of alcohol going on, a rapist would use a different kind of tool. Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I certainly am not a scientist in terms of studying everything that happens on BYU's campus or nationally for that matter. But anecdotally, what I've been hearing and certainly fits what we understand as how sexual assault happens is that if alcohol is not the most ready at hand tool the way it is on many campuses that have a culture of binge drinking, then rapists will simply use other tools. And so I think that's a frightening thought, and I think that's why we see a lot of denial in the conversations around sexual assault on BYU campus, that we would really like to believe it would be a comforting thought for all of us to think that if you just remove alcohol from the situation, now we don't have a sexual assault problem anymore.
Yeah.
And interestingly, BYU's honor code provides sort of a test case for that. Of course, drinking does happen with some students at BYU, but for the most part, I think they have a deserved reputation, as their Stone Cold Sober awards indicate. And yet, we still have sexual assault on that campus. And again, anecdotally, what we're hearing is in many of these cases, alcohol was not involved. And so rapists would rely on other tools, trust, an unwillingness to speak out strongly against a male who's exerting some authority. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things are concerns for what rapists might use as a tool.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to that idea of using authority as a tool. Andrea Redkamas, I want to get you on this. When you first heard about this story, did you think it was uniquely Mormon, or that was just, this is what happens in this country?
I first thought that this is kind of what happens in this country because we've heard so many cases from across the nation, other campuses, where young women are not getting justice, or they're being shamed, or they're rapists are still being allowed to attend school there, yeah, those kinds of things. But at the same time, I was concerned that aspects perhaps of Mormon university culture create a unique situation where this is allowed to happen, and particularly the difficulty of young women coming forward with the shame of having been raped, with the associations that come with that historically, culturally, socially.
There's this situation that seems kind of inconsistent to me. I'm not entirely sure this is true, but apparently the BYU counseling office, as I understand it, has this immunity that if someone comes to a counselor on campus and says, look, I'm really struggling with alcohol or pornography or something like that, that then that counselor wouldn't, as a matter of policy, go and report that to the Honor Code office. Mm-hmm. So why would a sexual assault be sent to the Honor Code office? I mean, what would the difference be? Can either of you comment on that?
I think that's a great question. I think that's the thing that everyone is trying to figure out now, is what would cause a rape to be reported to the Honor Code office. I think in part it comes from what your earlier guest was talking about, the Salt Lake Tribune reporter, that there's the association that other things are happening in accordance with the rape. Was the person drinking? It could be not even that. I think it could be something as simple as, was the individual in a boy's room when she shouldn't have been in a boy's room? Girls have been punished for that. And so there's a whole level of what a young woman's responsibility or culpability is perceived as in her own rape. And it could be something as simple as, did you enter his home or his apartment knowing that he was alone? And so that those things come very seriously with these honor codes that are in place at all three of the church's universities. There's a protectionism aspect to it, but there also is this leftover semblance of that young women are in part responsible for the policing of morality in our larger community, that young women's behavior is a driver or is a significant factor in how well young men behave. And there isn't that implicit assumption.
Cynthia Bailey Lee, do you want to comment on that point?
Yeah, as an observer of Mormon culture, have seen this for a long time, that we have this sense of, particularly in our discussion around modesty, something that women are responsible for attending to specifically, that we are responsible for attending to it so that we will not cause sinful thoughts in men. And I think although modesty is not a bad idea in itself, that way of talking about it can give us this idea that in a more general sense, women are responsible for any sexual impropriety that occurs because it was our responsibility to stop the men from their inexorable advance. Right. And I think that model of thinking is particularly unhelpful when we look at the sexual assault situation.
Back in 2012, there was this BYU student. Her name was Brittany Molina. And she told this story that you probably heard of because it went viral. She was, as she tells it, she was walking across the campus at Brigham Young University. And she's dressed in a fairly modest, I think they're called tunic dress. She has on a sweater, she has on leggings and boots, and a young man walks up to her and he hands her this note, and then he kind of cowardly scurries away. And this is what the note says. It says, "You may want to consider what you're wearing has a negative effect on men and women around you. Many people come to this university because they feel safe, morally as well as physically here. They expect others to abide by the honor code that we all agreed on. Please consider your commitment to the honor code when dressing each day. Thank you." What do you figure is going on? It was a young man, by the way. I'll just underline that, who handed her this note. What does that tell you, Andrea Radke-Moss?
Well, I'm present in a climate, in a work environment where this is very much part of the climate and the culture, is that there's this aspect of, you are special to be allowed to be into this university, so everyone should be able to abide by the honor code. It's that simple, because if you can't, then there's 10,000 people lined up who would love to take your place. When people are kind of flirting with the pushing against some of these stricter dress code requirements or behavior requirements, then it's easy for others to kind of police that. But definitely the gendered aspect of that says that in many ways our culture allows for young men, and not just young men, but older men, to basically comment on the bodies of females, and to do so kind of wholesale, that it's acceptable culturally for you to walk up to a female and comment on her physical body. And that is something, as Cynthia mentioned, that we might need to address kind of the underlying assumptions that we have about women's morality, about women's virtue, about women's their presence in our culture, and what the role of their presence in our culture is, and their physicality. And do men have the right to police that? And oftentimes women policing other women as well. And what is the line? What is the line of just reminding somebody, hey, you're not dressed according to the honor code. I signed the honor code. You should be able to sign it and obey it too, versus this kind of what seems like a more sinister element of it is, I'm allowed to come up and comment and objectify you as a human being. And that's a question that we need to, that's a discussion that we need to be having as a people and as a culture. And I think it's one of the underlying frameworks that we're dealing with here. Yeah.
I want to get a sense from both of you about how it is that Mormons are teaching young women and young men about chastity today, not in the past, but today. And a few years ago, Elizabeth Smart was speaking at this human trafficking forum, and she raised some really important questions about how some of the messages of purity that come from conservative cultures like Mormonism can actually end up blaming victims. But in her speech, she recalls this object lesson that is apparently has been used or is used in Mormon churches and in Mormon schools that equate a girl who has sex to a chewed up stick of gum. And there are various versions of these object lessons. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get a sense from both of you. Are these kinds of object lessons still being used? And what do they convey to young women and young men?
Yeah, so there's the chewed stick of gum. There's the licked cupcake. There's right. the piece of wood with a nail hammered into it. Am I missing any, Andrea? Yeah.
You probably are. But...
I think you've given us a good spectrum.
So... I hope these aren't being used anymore. I was very pleased to hear from President Uchtdorf in a talk that he gave. He talked about this $20 bill that was wadded up, and I forget what other indignities this $20 bill endured, but, you know, spat on, whatever it was. And but the ending of the story is that you could still go into a store and buy something with that $20 bill. It still retained its full value. And I know in my work with youth in the church, that is the story that I tell. But unfortunately, it wouldn't surprise me to hear that we are still teaching in some of our classes somewhere all around some of these other analogies that make it seem like having some sort of taint of sin of any kind, in particular sexual, is something from which you cannot recover.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the you in that is not a gender neutral. I think that really falls on our women and young women, that we are sending them the message that that impurity is an irreversible condition. And unfortunately, that brings in a whole slew of kind of evolutionary thinking mm-hmm. that humans have on impurity of things. And it can be a very powerful psychological tool for that reason. And it's it can be incredibly damaging for young women, whether consensual or not sexual activity has taken place, that they feel like something irreversible has been damaged there.
Let me read. Andrea Radkimas, I want to hear you on this point. Let me just add another element to maybe complicate it. So Spencer W. Kimball, who was a president of the LDS Church, wrote this. He said, "The far-reaching is the effect of the loss of chastity. Once given or taken or stolen, it can never be regained. Even in a forced context, such as rape or incest, the injured one is greatly outraged. If she has not cooperated and contributed to the foul deed, she is, of course, in a more favorable position. There's no condemnation where there's no voluntary participation, but it is better to die in defending one's virtue than to live having lost it without a struggle." Now, is that just a completely crazy dated impression, or is this concept, at least generally, still pervasive in Mormon culture today?
There's the $10,000 quote and question. This quote is a troublesome quote, and it's often been used, particularly among those that are critical of this kind of culture.
Yeah.
But you can trace it back to the 19th century, and sometimes even rape cases that would actually find their way to a court of law in the 19th century would ask, how much did the young woman struggle? how much did she fight, how much showed damage to her physical being that she actually fought back. The question always was to know how much, where was this young woman on the spectrum of being coerced, mm-hmm. of being cooperative, mm-hmm. as President Kimball used that word, or having absolutely resisted. If a woman actually died in the case of a rape, then oftentimes that woman's memory was lauded as this was a heroine, this was a heroine to morality, that she'd given up her life. I've seen tombstones that of dead rape victims that are these grand tombstones. So there was a sense of kind of like this code of honor in which a woman did give up her life and struggling as much as she could. And so I wonder if partly President Kimball's quote was informed by that culture, and that he was just taking it to an extreme level. Remember also that he wrote this in 1969, and the church was struggling a lot with the sexual revolution, with this new openness of sexuality, and where this caused vulnerability and anxiety on the margins of the church's ability to kind of police morality and to especially to guide the youth, to keep them virgins until they were married, to not have them buy into the sexual revolution. And so maybe to him, he was giving a warning that just came out so unfortunate and so sinister that he would basically incriminate rape victims in part of this whole breakdown of sexual morality. That's a quote. Fortunately,
Professor, it seems like the question now, though, is like, okay, 40 plus years ago, all right, that's the context for it. But again, the question is, does that idea in whatever form still persist in the way Mormons are teaching, talking to their young people?
You wonder how much it is, because even some suggestion of, well, how much were you coerced? When you come back to the alcohol thing, I don't even have to think we have to go to the extent of alcohol if the female was drunk and that limited her ability to respond. But if you even just go to, were you in his room? Were you in his room by yourself? Because that indicates some level of agreeability, some level of your own complicity in your own rape. And yeah, I think and that's where this blurring of lines has happened with the honor code, is if you can show that she was doing something, even the smallest thing wrong, that somehow that indicates a complicity in her own rape. And I think that those lines, we're going to have to sort those out, because it is suggestive that we're blaming the victim, that she's not fighting enough, that she's not resisting enough of her own the crime against her.
It's Andrea Radke Moss, professor of history at Brigham Young University in Idaho, in Rexburg, Idaho, joining us from there. Again, we'll just point out she's not speaking on behalf of BYU Idaho or the LDS Church. Cynthia Bailey Lee blogs about feminist issues for the Mormon blog By Common Consent. She's a lecturer at Stanford University. She's joining us from a studio there. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the story about BYU co-eds who had reported sexual assaults and then been reported to, and in some cases punished, by Brigham Young University for violating an honor code. Now, is this just a reflection of the broad situation, culture in America, or is it particular to Mormonism in some way? Andrea Radke Moss, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho, is joining us to talk about it, along with Cynthia Bailey Lee, a lecturer at Stanford University, who blogs about feminist issues for the Mormon blog By Common Consent. Holly Mullen, who is a local activist, said various roles. At one point, she was the executive director for the Rape Recovery Center. She sent us an email this morning. And in it, she said that male privilege is at the root of all sexual violence. She writes this: growing up Mormon, I have indelible memories of sitting with a group of female relatives at a after a family meal, cleaning up the kitchen, for instance, we're talking and we're laughing as we do. But if a male priesthood holder walked into the room and barked out his opinion or request for something completely off topic, it was suddenly as if Moses walked in. The women would quiet down, hush would fall, and they would just cavalierly take over the conversation. Now, it gets to that tool, Cynthia Bailey Lee, that you were mentioning before, this idea of using authority as a tool, you know, the privilege of having the priesthood. Would you talk about that element?
Sure. I think the role that a priesthood authority could play in a situation like this, you know, is twofold. One is that because we either all laity or none of us are, and at least the men in the Mormon church, it is the case that in a college situation, basically every male at BYU is a priesthood holder in the LDS church. Right. And so so there is a sense of authority there. And the way that we understand priesthood authority is that it has authority to administer official functions in the church structure, but that even in a romantic relationship, the priesthood authority has some authority there, at least after a marriage it would. The priesthood later would be presiding over the home as equals, whatever that means. But so... And I think that model of what things will look like after marriage can, you know, begin performing that even in a dating relationship. So I think that that's something that is a vulnerability in terms of our culture, that it creates a tool there. I don't know that, you know, it's inherent to that, but certainly if we're sort of looking at what are the tools on the table that could be manipulated, that is a lever.
Yeah.
Another way that I think it plays out often is the sense of reverence that there is in Mormon culture for the returned missionary.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly remember feeling like the returned missionaries that that I interacted with when I was undergraduate age had this aura about them of holiness, and it was just extremely difficult to believe a returned missionary, this very holy person, would be capable of something like rape. And so so unfortunately, what is a positive and earned with a lot of sacrifice, you know, it's a very real sacrifice that young men make to go on a mission, unfortunately, can lead to that kind of trust. The same thing, you know, we might see with affinity fraud in LDS culture, where there's just so much trust placed in that person that that could also be manipulated.
Professor Ed Kimas, what do you think about that?
Well, As I've been engaging in this issue and thinking about it and talking with a lot of people, I think there's an interesting intersection that's happening at, and probably happens at all three of the church universities, in which you have three largely Mormon communities in which the law enforcement is predominantly LDS, the university administrations, including honor code officials or security officials, are predominantly LDS, the families are LDS, and then you have the ecclesiastical leadership. So for a young woman who has been raped, she's engaging with three or four different levels of male authority: law enforcement, university authority, perhaps her father, her ecclesiastical leadership. And they're all male, predominantly male, but law enforcement, etc. And there's, if they're all LDS, then there's a sense of kind of male protection of each other, perhaps, or male defense of each other. And I don't know how much this plays out, but for a young woman who has been a victim of a rape, whether or not she is validated or heard or her rape accusation is accepted and believed falls on three or four different pillars of male authority. What if two or three of those pillars fall? What if her bishop doesn't believe her? What if the law enforcement doesn't believe her? But maybe her family does. Or maybe her bishop actually does believe her, but the university doesn't and takes punitive action against her. Then basically she's being betrayed by three or four different levels of male authority. And it's only if all three or four of those levels were to come together and were to be equal or were to be uniform in their response, would she feel validated? Would she feel like she was believed? And would we be able to right these wrongs? But my fear is that that's not happening, because when women tell their rapes or when women need to tell their stories, they're having to tell male authorities on all different levels.
There's a comment from, I'm afraid we weren't able to get to Chris's call, but he said, I can't escape the connection to conservative Islam and this story, how they blame women for men's urges. What about the honor code protecting her honor? I mean, is there a corollary there? Do you think Andrea Radke Moss or Cynthia Bailey Lee between, not honor killing, obviously, but the basic concept about the destruction of a person's honor, something, and you know, something just lost.
I'll just take it quickly. I think that there is a protectionism aspect to it, and that's where you get into the specifics. If you were to read, and all three of the honor codes are different. I don't know if you've read all three of them, but each university has the right to parse out specifics that are unique to that university.
Wait, they're different?
There are different aspects to each of the honor codes.
Like,
yes.
Give me an example. Like, what's
well, for instance, at BYU Idaho, whereas at BYU you're allowed to wear shorts, at BYU Idaho you're not even allowed to wear capris. So in Rexburg, long pants are required.
Wow.
Whereas at BYU, shorter pants are okay, and then similar at Laie or BYU Hawaii. I don't know the specifics of BYU Hawaii's honor code, but each university is allowed to have different kind of unique things to their honor code. But I think that notion of that these specifics of don't go into a boy's bedroom, don't be in an apartment or home by yourself with him if he's alone, curfew hours, all those different things, those can also differ from university to university as well. That is in a way of a protection element, but at the same time, it comes back to this notion of, well, if something does happen, and one of these small things went wrong, you were in his room or his apartment, then you are partly to blame for your own rape.
Professor Bailey Lee, what do you think?
I think that we really like to think of all the commandments and guidelines that we receive in the church as performing a service for us, which is protecting us from things going wrong. And I think they can be viewed that way. I think we advertise them that way, and they do perform that role in certain respects. Certainly, if you are obeying the guideline not to ever consume alcohol, you are protected from being an alcoholic, but it doesn't mean you're protected from any bad thing happening to you ever. And unfortunately, I think though we understand that in some ways, we sort of lose track of that when it comes specifically to sexual assault, that we put more faith in the honor code in terms of its ability to protect young women or young men from sexual assault than really exists. Mm. And that's something I've seen again and again in the conversation about this news about BYU, is the sense of, well, the, you know, sure, rape is, you know, somehow theoretically possible if you're following the honor code, but the odds, you know, is just almost can't happen. And I think that is a misconception. And it's a misconception that hurts victims. I don't think it's coming from a cruel place. I think people just would like to imagine that, you know, their daughters are not at risk for something this frightening, but it becomes cruel when it is collectively applied to an understanding of a sexual assault that has happened and is just not accurate. And then it starts manifesting in victim blaming. It starts manifesting in, you know, this desire to investigate, because surely if we investigate long enough, we'll find that place where the survivor went wrong, and we'll all then be able to go home and sleep comfortably knowing that if we just don't do that thing, it could never happen to us or it could never happen to our daughters.
You know, at what point is it, do you remove all vulnerability for a young woman? Sometimes, in some of these cases, it's a case of naivete. Are these the younger, the freshmen and sophomores where this is happening to because they believe a boy when he says, well, I just want you to come and look at my computer? Or what if they're in a car, but they're on a reasonable date before curfew hours, they just happen to be by themselves, and he has power over the vehicle. I mean, there's so many levels and areas where you can't completely remove the vulnerability, even if the honor code is being complied with.
And that's where I think this could also manifest in dangerous ways, and where, unfortunately, some of these analogies to, you know, to how women treated in certain countries in the Middle East, you know, might become more salient is if there is a sense of wanting to ratchet up the, you know, well, we still have sexual assault. Well, let's not allow this or that anymore. And I just, it's not possible to, nor would it be desirable in any way to restrict the activities of people to an extent that would somehow eradicate the risk of sexual assault.
Let me mention, I just want to say that Andrea Redke Moss in March gave this fascinating paper on the Mormon-Missouri War of 1838, where, as most people know, she talked about this evidence of one of the founding mothers of Mormonism, Eliza R. Snow, having been a victim of gang rape. I'll put that aside for now, and Andrea Radke Moss will have you back on, because some of the parallels to this story are interesting. It's also just a terribly tragic, fascinating story. I'm afraid we didn't get to it this time, but we'll have you back for that. Andrea Radke Moss, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And Cynthia Bailey Lee blogs about feminist issues for the Mormon blog By Common Consent, a lecturer at Stanford University, joined us from a studio there. Thank you to you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.